This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moskowain. First up on today's show, we'll hear a portion of my interview with Sean Monahan, an aspiring stand-up comedian who makes YouTube videos about the infamous and often misunderstood Philadelphia accent. I spoke with him a few years ago about the quirks of the Philly accent, had him quiz me on how to pronounce certain words, and we discussed why people still don't understand Philly slang. Vocal coach Joanne Joella also joined us in studio. Let's take a listen to an excerpt of one of his videos.
Where do you guys want to go Friday? Up in Mounds or down shore?
So I was sleeping last night and heard this ale outside my window. Hooting. Woke me up. And I saw this big old spider on my pillow.
Did you eat breakfast yet?
No, Jew.
Hey, what you was doing today? Can I get you something to drink, hon?
Can I get a can of soda, please? I'm a human being. Treat me with respect, please.
You're far. Points four.
Damn Dennis. Pull my teeth out.
Atlantic City is too touristy anymore.
Yeah, it was at what, like at least 100 people at that party last night, huh?
That guy makes me so frustrated.
Used to take baths when I was little. Now I just take showers. And I dry the water off with a towel afterwards.
We were enjoying that, Sean, as we listened to you talk the Philadelphia accent. When did you realize you had a Philadelphia accent?
Well, there were little indications, I guess, when I was growing up, but I didn't really figure it out until I went away to college, which was out in Ohio, where they like to say they don't have an accent. They right. do, they do, but it's not nearly as noticeable as the Philly accent. And so there's a lot of differences between how I talked and how my friends at college talked. And from what I understand of the little bit of sociolinguistics research that I've read,
yes.
people try to talk like their peers. So that's when I started to lose my accent because none of my friends there
right.
talked like me. So, I started to talk like them.
So do you hear your accent now as you speak it? Do you hear your
Now I do it because I started making the
this
videos.
This is your job, right?
That would be a nice job
yeah.
if someone paid me to do this.
Exactly.
But, once you start thinking about an accent, it's hard to stop thinking about it, I guess. So I do notice how I talk and how all the people around me talk now. But a few years ago, that wasn't the case so much.
You have a little flash card. This will work on the radio. I
right.
promise our listeners.
Okay, so here's the first word.
And this is the word eagle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to eagle.
Right. Like, let me see the sentence I have written here. How about them eagles? It's a very something you hear all the time. All right.
All right. All right.
And then this one.
Oh, okay. This Friday.
Friday? It's pronounced Friday. Friday.
Friday.
Like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
As opposed to Friday.
Friday. We have a very complex short A system where
All right, go ahead.
Depending on what consonant comes after the vowel, it'll either become A or A. So half the time it's A and half the time it's A.
And I hear that in the way you say
right.
half.
Right.
Half
and so,
the time.
Yeah. And so like we would say... Have this pie, and that means I want you to take it.
Right.
But if we say have this pie, that means I want you to cut it in half.
So, oh goodness
this
gracious!
Is, this is one thing.
This is getting more and
yeah.
more complicated.
No, it's a very very complex system
yes.
of how we talk. It's we get it like the back of our hand, but it is very complicated.
Well, I'm not sure if this is one of your words, Sean, but I'm thinking of the word Philadelphia. And I even find myself having to be careful, and I don't always do it correctly, pronouncing all those syllables, because I think in many ways what we sound like here is Philadelphia. Philadelphia.
Well, we do something funny with our L's. It's pretty unique across the country. Most people touch their tongue to their teeth when they say L, like that. But we like make it in the back of our throat, like we're swallowing the sound. So, and very few English accents do that. It's like us and Pittsburgh and African American vernacular English, and also New Zealand English. I think randomly.
That's interesting. Now, how do you say Philadelphia?
So instead of Philadelphia, it's Philadelphia.
Philadelphia.
Yeah. And so you wouldn't say I love Philadelphia. You'd say I love Philadelphia.
Can you continue with your
sure.
With your flashcards here for us?
All right. Okay. So what is this word? A-R-N.
Arn? Oh, I know what that is. Arn.
Yeah.
Iron.
Right. Yep. Got to strike while the iron's hot.
Yep. A-R-N
for
arn.
We do funny things with our eyes.
We do.
The South does this thing where I think they call it glide dropping, where instead of saying I, they say ah. So like they would say arn or... The rot Tom to do that, instead of right time.
Which has a kind of southern-y sound to it, doesn't it?
And we do that some of the time. We do that for words like iron and walk down the aisle instead of the aisle or things like that. But a lot of the time, we also do this other thing that started in Canada called Canadian raising, where we turn some long I sounds into oi, like right or nice or mic or high school.
High school,
that sort of thing, and that all depends on what vowel comes after what consonant comes after the vowel.
And I love the way you say the word vowel.
Yeah, vowel. People have such a hard time understanding us because almost all our vowels are different.
Are you now this spokesperson cheerleader for the Philadelphia accent?
It looks like at least the news media is trying to turn me into that.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I find sort of funny because I actually don't have as strong an accent as many people in this city do. Because I grew up in the suburbs, and the suburbs don't have different accents. They're just less to a lesser degree, the same accent to a lesser degree than people who grew up in the city.
Right.
So I am like intentionally trying to make it stronger now, just because I think it's cool. But I don't know.
This is something that you've said, and frankly, we've thought about as well. In fact, we were looking for some kind of movie clip that could highlight this Philadelphia accent. If we wanted a movie from Brooklyn, I think we could find it. The Boston accent is one that you see in movies as well. Mm-hmm. But it seems like Philadelphia actors don't get this Philadelphia accent very well.
Yeah, so a couple summers ago, I watched this movie, Invincible, which is about the Eagles, and it takes place in Philadelphia. But everybody in that movie is talking in a New York accent, and it drove me nuts. And I was watching it with people who weren't from this area, so no one else had a problem about it but me.
All right.
So I'm like, oh, no, he would never say, I don't know. Like, they were dropping their R's all over the place, and we never do that here. Right. Player, we'd always say it like that. We would never say playa or something like that.
So they were sort of appropriating a Brooklyn-y, Bronx-y, New York-y thing.
And in my second video, Philly Accent in the Media, I have a short clip of Invincible and Rocky and, History of Violence, where they also do that.
They don't get it right.
No, they get the New York accent perfect, but that's not how we talk.
Right.
So I mean, I guess they figure people in California won't know the difference between, or if they had people actually talking the Philadelphia accent, they would never have heard it before. So they would just think, why are these actors talking ridiculously like that? It's a self-perpetuating prophecy because if they never include the Philadelphia accent in national media, then no one knows what it is. But they won't include it because no one knows what it is.
Well, we'd done the word iron or arn. And I grew up in part in Delaware as a kid where we talked about tar instead of tire.
The tires on your car.
Tars on the cars. we also said arn. That's why, to me, it has this kind of southern-y, Delmarva Peninsula influence as well, the way Philadelphians talk.
Philadelphia used to be a southern city in speech. Right. It used to be pretty indistinguishable from the rest of the South, as I understand it.
Yeah.
And then, at some point in the 20th century, it started to reverse its orientation. Probably the Civil War had something to do with it, but we started to act more like a northern city. Yeah. And so that's when we started developing these other characteristics. And actually, one thing that's important to take away here is that the Philly accent is changing, as all accents are, and it's changing quicker than every other accent, as far as I understand it, in all of North America. This oi sound we talked about earlier, that's a very recent development. People 40 years ago weren't even doing that at all in Philadelphia. And so they started doing it a little bit, like there's a mic instead of mic. But then, like, with each preceding generation, they would it would get stronger. And so kids who are coming up through elementary school today say it even stronger than I do. So they would be like, I would say moik, but they would probably say moik, moik.
Moik.
Like it gets stronger and stronger and stronger with each generation.
Do you want to do a couple more words with us,
yeah, sure.
Sean, just to complete the list here?
A-R-S-H.
Arsh?
Yeah, what do you think this means?
Arsh.
It's, I'll give you the sentence. My family's Irish Catholic.
Okay, what else?
All right, and then this has to do with that.
Oh, lig.
Right. What is that?
Leg?
No.
Oh, no?
The Phils play in the National League.
Okay, and that's league as in L-I-G.
Right.
Right, exactly. What else? Uh-oh. Dirty fish treat.
Dirty fish treat.
There you go.
We do this thing before, an S before a T-R becomes sh, so we say street instead of street.
Right.
Or straight, strong.
Strong.
All those words, they all get that S-H at the beginning. And so, Fifth Street is always Fish Street, like F-I-S-H Street.
How do you say water?
Wooder.
Wooder.
It's like wood, like on a tree, with an E-R at the end.
Now, just relax your jaw and see what that's.
Well, when I was away at college, I started saying water instead. And that's not exactly how my friends were saying it. They were saying water, but I was saying water.
Water.
Which is, I guess, like the Philadelphian approximation of how you would say water, because that just feels so unnatural.
Yeah. Do people still say use in Philadelphia?
Yep. Yes, they do. A lot of people see that as a really important part of the accent, and it is, but it's not something that only we say. Like, New Yorkers say that. I think people all over the northern cities say that, like as far as Cleveland and pretty much any industrial working class person, unless they're in the South where they say y'all. Or in Pittsburgh where they say yins.
Oh, interesting.
Almost everybody says yiz, as far as I know, or yous. But I think yiz is specifically Philly. Like, how yous doing?
Yeah,
like, I don't think anyone else says that.
You live in Philly now. I mean, do you hear, like, from Fishtown to South Philly to West Philly to North Philly to Northeast Philly, do you hear... Now that you're kind of attuned to this accent, do you hear
people are so insistent that there's a very distinct, like, Pennsport accent versus Fishtown or Manayunk versus Northeast and all that stuff. But, you know, I don't believe them. I don't buy it. Like, because whenever I ask, okay, so what do they say different? They don't know what to say. They're like, oh, no, we don't stand anything like those guys. But then I ask the other people, and they're like, oh, no, we don't stand anything like those guys, you know? So, and like, linguistic research has yet to find anything that's different between even, like, the suburbs of Philly and Philly itself, like Delaware County versus Bucks County on totally different sides of the city. If you're a white working class or middle class person, you're still talking pretty much the same.
Yeah.
You're talking like someone from the city, but just to a lesser extent, usually, if you're from a suburb. And within the city itself, I don't think there's really any differences. Although people are really insistent that there are.
That was my 2011 interview with Philly resident and aspiring comedian Sean Monahan. A few years back, he started making YouTube videos about the Philadelphia accent on his Philly Talk channel. Coming up after the break, we'll hear an excerpt of my interview with basketball icon Bill Russell. We wanted to talk basketball in honor of the NBA Finals, which wrapped up this week. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Bill Russell was one of the most prolific winners in the history of sports. Called the 20th century's greatest winner by Sports Illustrated, Russell racked up NBA championships and Olympic gold. He also served as a foil to another basketball great, Wilt Chamberlain, who played for the 76ers when they had winning seasons. The two duked it out over 10 years together in the NBA. Russell joined me in 2001 to discuss his book, Russell Rules. We discuss his career, his friendship and rivalry with Chamberlain, his coaching and playing styles, and his Louisiana roots. Let's take a listen. Well, you write about something called the Celtic Pride.
Yes.
What is that?
That's a culture, the way we operate our team. There are a lot of things that go into it. And we want to demystify it in that we were a bunch of men that went out and played basketball quite well.
Yes, you did.
And and we got to the top, and we stayed on the top for a long period of time. And these are some of the things that went into making this team.
Well, you were a bunch of men, and as you say, the Celtics played like kids without being childish.
Right.
That you played like children.
Yes. Well, that's the enthusiasm, the joy, and the fun. But being childish is a grown-up thing.
Sure, sure, sure. A lifelong thing.
And so being childish is like losing control of your ego or your composure and et cetera, you know, and throwing temper tantrums and all that kind of stuff. Well, we didn't do that.
Was it always fun? I mean, did you know it was a good game when you were having fun? Was that one way of understanding that things were working on the court?
Well, you know, it's like what was fun for me. For me, it was going out and seeing what we figured out, what we have to do to win. You know, and a lot of guys that I've talked to over the years that thought when they were playing against me, and this is throughout the league, that they had a better team. And I'm very a gracious winner. I always say the best team always wins.
You're talking about mind games here, are you not?
Yes. Yeah. You know, in that we had what made us a good team, we were very versatile psychologically, intellectually, and physically, in that we could play any type of game. It was part of our repertoire, and we knew how to apply that night so we could be competitive with the team we're playing.
You also write about the fact, and this is really talking about yourself, is that you saw the game in a sort of in a vertical way,
and
a horizontal way.
Yes,
but you had this sort of visual sense, I guess, of the game and the flow of the game.
Yes, you know, like I had a competition with Wilt. See, it was not a rivalry, as far as I'm concerned. The difference is, in a rivalry, one would have to be vanquished. And that did not happen. We both were enormously successful in what we were doing, although we were doing the same thing in a completely different style or approach. And so what I used to get great pleasure out of was to look at a team, see their strengths and weaknesses, and play to their strengths. And the reason I say that is in basketball, the great players are consistent. That's one of the things that makes them great, is that a guy can say take 18 feet and hit 18 out of 20. Mm-hmm. Well, that's consistency. Well, that's what you have to count on with the great players, is they're going to be consistent. So then you can figure out how to play against them. If I went to play against him and I wasn't ready to play, I would be totally embarrassed. You know, it just basically run out of the gym. Because I remember one night here in Philadelphia, he got 55 rebounds against us. That was...
I bet he enjoyed that.
I'm sure he did. I don't think I did. He knew that when he's going to play against the Celtics, that he was going to, if he didn't want to get embarrassed, then he'd have to play his very best. And I knew the same thing when I got ready to play his teams. And
you were good for each other then on the court.
Yes. And then because of curiosity in doing this, you would find out some things maybe that you didn't know you could do that you didn't know you could do.
You're 6'10", right? And when you played 6'10", 220, he was 7'1", 275. So you had 3 inches on you and about 50 pounds.
Yeah, he was quite a load. I miss him because my career and his career are together. And because it was a competition and not a rivalry. And that made a difference psychologically in that neither was ever vanquished.
Hmm.
You understand what I mean? And so we're both enormously successful in what we did. And so that it was part of my existence.
Let me just pick up on one more thing about you and Wilt Chamberlain, which is certainly he racked up the points, but you were on a team that racked up wins and championships. And you talk in your book about this sort of team ego and an individual ego, of which Wilt Chamberlain had gobs, I guess. He had a man with a large ego. But you say really tempered by his honesty. I mean, there were personality traits that made that ego very, very kind of attractive in its own kind of way.
Well, you know, what I would to describe the differences is that management styles, basically. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's inside out and outside in. Now, Wilt was an enormous, not only presence, but an enormous talent. Like he was always, when he was young especially, if they had a race the length of the court, he would be the fastest man on the team. And he could jump and touch the top of the backboard. And he was really smart, which created problems. And he thought, and I think correctly so, that if I take this enormous skill and talent and really work at it and play as hard as I can, my team should win. Because basketball, one guy can really have an enormous influence. In fact, he used to work so hard that every game he'd have to change jerseys at halftime.
Really?
Because the one that he the first half would be so wet from sweat that he had to take it off. So he was a guy working hard at his craft. And so he went out and played as hard as he could and using most of his, all his skills as much as possible. Well, I, in turn, approach this as a team game. There will be nights when I'm not going to have a good night. Okay. Now, but my team still has to win that night. So what I had to do was involve as many of my teammates as possible in our offense and our defense so that I would take my style of play and my talent and skills and whatever skills I needed to use with this particular group, I would alter what I was doing so that what I was doing is playing in style, using my talent, and being invisible.
Well, yeah, you talk about being invisible, and I'm thinking, how does a guy 6'10"? I realize you're in the land of giants there on a basketball court, but how do you be invisible in such an intense competitive game?
Well, there are a couple ways. Physically, you could do it because the great players have good eyesight.
Yeah,
and they can focus in and out. And like if they're when they're just running, they focus on the whole picture. But when they're going to shoot a pass, they narrow it in like a beam of light. And if you step outside of that beam of light, they can't see you.
They don't even know you're there, right?
But also in other things, your presence can be felt in terms of what your teammates or your co-workers, whatever, think about you. And so when they're doing something, they think about what you would advise them to do. And so it's like my mother died when I was 12, but she had influence even today.
A kind of real invisible presence in your life.
Right. Now, we know that one guy can dominate a league, but the glorious thing to me is that we don't know what the next is going to look like. Is he going to be tall? Is he going to be short? Is he going to be fat? Like one of the things that I really enjoy is that we're getting a lot of foreign players. And what the NBA is bringing to the American public is the best basketball players on the planet. And it doesn't make any difference where they come from or what they look like, you know. And that these are the people that can play this game the best.
I love sort of trying to figure out where people came from and who were some of the influences in their life. And talking about your parents and your life growing up, you grew up in Louisiana, born in there.
I was born in Louisiana, 1934. And we moved to California when I was 9.
Right.
And that's when I was introduced to basketball.
Your mom played some basketball as a girl. So part of the Bloomer Girls?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
And that was kind of a shock to you, I guess, when your dad said that.
Yes.
You didn't know that?
No, I didn't. You know, she was a remarkable lady, very versatile, and she used to tell me things. And you know, it's funny. It's like she'd tell me things like when I was 2 or 3 years old. Mm-hmm. And I would remember them when I was 40. You know, it's like, you know, it's like a voice, a ghost talking to you. But the things were implanted, and sometimes they just come and pop out.
Well, she, as you said, she died when you were 12, but she was determined for you to get a college education, that was really her goal for her children.
Yes, yes. My father went to the 6th grade, but he had made my promise to my mother that he would send the boys to college. And so in 3 generations, my father went to 6th grade, I went to college, and my daughter went to law school. And so this is like the evolution of this family. We didn't have any money, but we were never poor, because he said that being poor is a state of mind. Being broke is a temporary situation. And so that we were going to do things to make it better.
And I can imagine Louisiana 1930s, you probably knew people who had been slaves.
My father had conversations with people, his aunts and grand aunts, that had been slaves. And so it was not history to him. It was current events.
Did he talk about it?
Not much, because some of the times that stuff can be depressing. But it also can be enlightening. And if you come to a situation, you got to find out what happened and how you can make it better.
He's quoted as saying, obviously a very strong work ethic, accept responsibility for your actions, honor thy father and mother, and if they give you $10 for a day's work, you give them $12 worth in return. This was your father, the sort of advice that he gave to his children.
Well, the reason he said that was that if I come to work for you, I will do my job better than what you're paying. And so after that, leave me alone.
But did you do that on the basketball court? Do you feel like that's sort of part of how you approach the game?
Well, I know that Red Auerbach, who went through a whole bunch of things to get me to Boston.
Yeah.
He had certain expectations. He wanted a player that could come in and rebound and at least guard the other centers. He didn't know the extent of my skills. I remember one time at the end of my rookie year, I'd missed the first third of the season, so I'm there the last 40-something games, and about 10 games to go, he calls. He says, can you come to the game early tomorrow? He should do that. And I says, okay. So I come here, and he says, do you know how good you are? And I said, yes. He said, I didn't know you were that good. And I said, well, I did. And he says, you're the best basketball player playing basketball now. And I said, I knew that. But
he didn't know that.
No.
He didn't know that.
But what I did was I came in and I learned what this team, all the guys were about, what they did, and how I could be a teammate.
Huh.
And how they could be a teammate. And so that we could cover all bases.
When you began to play, and you were in Boston a lot, we don't necessarily always think of northern cities as racist, but I know you had to deal with a lot of pretty bad situations, taunts.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny is that I think of myself as a pachyderm, thick-skinned.
Right. Well, you have to be, don't you?
And so a lot of things, maybe even disproportionately, had no impact on me.
Really?
Yeah, and so
it just didn't penetrate.
Well, to start with, when I went to the Celtics, Walter Brown, the original owner of the Celtics, was one of the finest, most decent men I've ever met in my life. In fact, when the Celtics hired their first black player, he said to him, the Boston Celtics will never, ever do anything to embarrass you. Now, this was like in 1946, okay? So that's the way Walter... And when I went to the Celtics, There was, at least to me, no indication of race in that locker room. Now, it was very interesting. In the finals my rookie year, I was the only black player on either team.
Really?
And it was, but I think, from the indication I got, is that all we ever looked at was how did the players play on my team and on the other team. Over the years, one of the guys that we've become friends is Bob Pettit, who played for the Hawks at that time. And St. Louis was far, far, far more racist than Boston could ever hope to be. You know, the things that, of course, my life has been a joy. And the things is, when I come to a situation, the way I look at situations, most situations are neutral. The way they impact you or the way you view them is what makes them positive or negative.
Hmm.
And so I always run to a situation as much as possible. I took control of it, and so that I would end up coming out of the other end doing what I wanted to do and making the situation turn out the way I wanted it to turn out.
You were the first black coach, yes, in the NBA.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you feel that you were breaking that color barrier? Did you feel that you were opening doors? It was a job. It was...
Well, you see, with the Celtics, we always wanted to put the best person for the job in the job. And so I think I might have been offended if I thought that was part of the reason that Red picked, asked me to coach.
The color of your skin, you mean?
Yeah.
If he'd done it just for
He knew that I would be the best guy for that particular job at that particular time. Because very subtly, I had a tendency to be cranky sometimes.
I like that word, cranky. Does it mean you were a taskmaster?
Well, you know, it's that I had this thing the way I was, and it was not very flexible. Uh-huh. You understand me?
My way or the highway? Is that
what you're saying? Well, no. It's that my way is that I wanted everything to be geared toward winning the game, and I had no tolerance for any other approach. And so when Red left, what kind of coach were we going to have? Mm. You know what I mean? And so Red and I collaborated. I tell you, like, I watched teams play. Now, when Michael was with Chicago.
Michael Jordan, yeah.
Yes. So you don't have to put all that. You don't have to put Jordan there when you say Michael.
I know. I just in case someone's joining us. I have to be the eyes and ears right. of the audience.
One of the things that I noticed, you'd always see at timeouts, he and Phil, coach, talking. And because guys like Michael, myself, Magic, during timeouts, you see them consulting. It's like the assistant coach on the floor, you know. And that's one of the things I talk about in management, in that outside in, inside out.
That's right.
One of the great assets that my coach had was that he great listener. Now, listening is not, I'll shut up while you talk. Listening is hearing what you say, translate it into the language that I can understand, get the information, and make decisions based on the information. But it's like I might have to ask you to define your terms three times. But whenever you hear me say, yes, but, you've lost me. You have to respect the players and so I go so far as to say you respect people, that you, even people you don't like.
What a thrill. That was my interview with basketball great Bill Russell from 2001. With the NBA Finals concluding this week with a big win for the Golden State Warriors, we wanted to hear from the man whose name is on the NBA Finals MVP award. Coming up after the break, we'll hear a portion of my interview with guitarist Raul Midon. He's currently on tour for his latest album, Don't Hesitate. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We listen now to my interview with Raul Midon. The blind New Mexican musician brought his guitars to the studio 5 years ago, and we were in awe of his music, mouth trumpeting, and other vocal skills. He's currently on tour for his new album, Don't Hesitate. Midon is known for his progressive genre-bending songs. He played some old and new songs for us while he was in town, and we talked about what it's like to be a blind musician. Let's take a listen. Well, you have brought several guitars, including a steel guitar, and I'd love to have you play a song called Why Am I Feeling So Bad?
Yeah, this is kind of reflects my interest in sort of a certain kind of folk or stride guitar. So this is how this goes. Feeling so bad. Why am I feeling so bad? I got more than I've ever had. Why am I feeling so bad? Why am I feeling so blue? Why am I feeling so blue? You got me and I got you. Why am I feeling so blue? Get me some sleep. Why can't I get me some sleep? I got all my troubles piled up in a heap. Why can't I get me some sleep? Now maybe this highway is taking my soul. And maybe I feel like I'm losing control. Maybe that's a good thing, I don't know. Maybe one day I'll get on a roll and I'll be glad. Then I won't feel so bad. treatment's way. Why does she treat me this way? Maybe I'll leave her and maybe I'll stay. Why does she treat me this way? Yeah. Now maybe this highway is taking my soul. And maybe I feel like I'm losing control. Maybe that's a good thing, I don't know. Maybe one day I'll get on a roll and I'll be glad. Then I won't feel so bad.
That was great. Raul Madan, our guest today on Radio Times, a song called Why Am I Feeling So Bad? And I'm curious, as a songwriter, do you start with lyrics? Do you start with a piece of a melody? Do you have a certain way that you approach your songwriting?
It's all of the above. I think a lot of times a piece of music will come to mind, some sort of a, you know, what the music will suggest the lyric, I'd say, for me a lot of the time. But it's never, I haven't found a formula yet exactly for it.
Which is probably a good thing, isn't it?
I guess, yeah. Maybe it'd be a good thing if I did. But
well, you do sort of don't fit into certain categories.
Yeah, that's a blessing and a curse, I guess. It's who I am. I don't fit into a specified genre. I just love music, and I love combining the elements of music that really speak to me. So, you know, I grew up with Latin music and Brazilian music and soul music and you know, great songwriters and just everything.
Well, and I read that you grew up in, as you just described, a really musical household. Your dad was a dancer?
Yes. He danced a kind of dance called folclore and an Argentine folk dancing. So there was a lot of different kinds of music, but that was certainly one of the things that I grew up with. Very sort of interesting rhythms. You know, there's stuff like that. So it's very... like every folk tradition has sort of a specialized sound to it.
And your family listened to everything, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we would listen to, you know, an Ornette Coleman record and then you know, put on an opera or something or Stockhaus. I mean, my dad had it has an amazing record collection. Mm. So, and we would listen the way that, I don't know, people watch a movie or the way that we would gather around and listen. And it wouldn't be like it would be on in the background while we were hanging out. This was in our house, listening was a focused family affair, you know.
And I should add to that, and because we're on the radio, people won't know this, but first of all, you have a twin brother.
Yes.
And both of you are blind.
Yes.
And blind as a result of being in an incubator with incorrect amount of oxygen, is that right?
Right, right. Yeah, there was a generation of people in the 60s that were born sort of right after incubators were introduced, but wow, before they realized that the eyes would be damaged by oxygen. So that's kind of what happened with us.
So you've never seen? I know that your brother had a little bit of sight for a while.
My brother had the same thing happen to him, but some of his retina was salvaged by a doctor with some very, very pioneering laser surgery at the time.
Wow.
I think it might have been 1970 or 1969, somewhere in there. And so he was able to attach a part of my brother's retina back on, and my brother saw until he was about 15, and then it came loose again. Yeah.
But as you said, you listened to music the way people would watch movies. But obviously, was the music sort of movies for you? that there were stories and
sure,
things that you listened for.
Sure. I mean, I think it was very clear to everyone that I was very into music from an early age, and you know, played percussion and played all kinds of stuff. I mean, I started taking guitar lessons when I was six, so you know, I've been into it for my whole life, really.
Well, I do want to have you play another song, but even before we get to that, I'm fascinated by this software that you use that allows you to edit your work, and I'm curious how that works.
Basically, what it does is it talks. It allows you to manipulate the display so you can make the so your computer will talk to you and tell you where you are, where you want to cut, where you want to paste. It will give you all kinds of parameters of things that you manipulate when you record, whether it's reverb or compression or audio level and all that sort of thing.
So being allowed to edit your own work, is the music different? Do you hear it differently? Do you approach it differently?
I think it just gives you it gives me the ability to create music anytime I want and to sculpt it into something that I can send out to somebody or that I can use or that could be a record in and of itself. I think that it gives you freedom, really.
Well, I'd love to have you play another song, and I should say you're now using a nylon guitar, and this is a song called Bonnie's Song. First of all, why the nylon? What do you get out of a nylon guitar you don't get from the steel string?
It's just a different sound, and depending on what you're talking about and how you're playing, it gives you a different. It's a warmer sound, so it's although the strings sound warmer than sort of the steel sound. So this is a completely non-autobiographical song. It's just based on a character that came out of somebody that I knew, but it really isn't about them. It just sort of started that way. It's called Bonnie's Song.
Bonnie floats through marshmallow sky, twilight caresses her face, gliding above all the where and the why. She's a picture of beauty and grace. Streetlights and buildings go wandering by, and so does the edge of the coast, counting lovers in casual eyes, wondering which one has hurt her the most. She can go anywhere she wants, and she can go side of the sea, and all around there are people gathered there, gathered all just to be with an angel woman and her long brown hair, women who dared to be free. They turned their heads in a mind's eye stare, and suddenly they could see they could go anywhere.
Guest Raul Madan, and I should say that little trumpet sound we heard was you.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the kind of what is it, mouth trumpet?
Yeah, it's a way of creating an instrument with your voice, and I really worked on sort of articulating it so that it sounds more like an instrument. And what I mean by articulation is how you get from note to note. So, you know, so that you get this sort of hopefully very precise way of you know, something that people normally don't hear from the voice, I guess.
Well, and I was watching you. I can see, I mean, I couldn't see your tongue, but it was clear your tongue was doing something while you were making those notes.
Yeah, I mean, a trumpet player uses their tongue to articulate the notes. So, it's all, you know, sort of the tongue, the lips, but... And I, by the way, I have no idea whether it's the way that a trumpet player does it or not. I just go by the sound of it.
So did you ever play the trumpet?
I never did, no.
But you like the sound of the trumpet?
I love the sound of the trumpet. I was a huge Miles Davis fan when I was a kid. And, you know, records like Sketches of Spain and the Gil Evans, all the Gil Evans stuff. And then I got into Clifford Brown for a while, who's a very articulate trumpet player. Who plays very in a specific kind of way for those people who know about that. But it sort of captured my imagination, I guess.
And were you just, as a kid, noodling around and discovered that you could make these noises?
Yeah, it was that way. And I never really thought of it as, wow, this is a way that I can get the audiences to, you know. I never thought of it that way. I know some people have said, oh, this is, you know, his gimmick or whatever. It never occurred to me. It was a purely musical exploration for me, the reason I started doing that.
Well, it sounds great, and it looks great as well, I should say. As you said, you've been playing guitar since you were about 6 years old?
Yeah.
Did you find yourself gravitating to that instrument, or was it given to you, or how did you hook up with a guitar?
I really think it's because it's what was around. Oh. You know, I think if there had been a big grand piano in the living room, maybe I would have played that. I it's hard to say why people pick up certain instruments. I think that's probably one of those things that it will never be completely known. But it was around. My mother had it, and so. It was the instrument that I picked up.
Used to sit and worry about the future. Worrying about the future don't change the past.
Used to think tomorrow. That was an excerpt of my 2011 interview with singer and guitarist Raul Midon on his music and unusual vocal skills. He's currently on tour for his latest album, Don't Hesitate. You're listening to his State of Mind. That was a song that launched his career. And that wraps up Radio Times in Review for this week. We hope you enjoyed it. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. Emily Bryant edited today's edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Have a great weekend, and thanks for joining us.
Wake up in the morning and I turn the pages. Don't understand what's going down. Everybody's acting so outrageous. It's gonna take a lot of love to turn things around.